Mariah Remote, I'm Jim Bertel. Israel's army says it received a rocket warning in the north of the country, the first time sirens have been heard there since conflict between Israel and the Palestinians flared up again earlier this week. It's a sign the long-running Middle East situation may be worsening. The rising violence between Israel and the Palestinians is disrupting U.S. air travel to the troubled region. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
The top three U.S. airlines that fly to Israel have suspended those flights. Amid the escalating violence, the worst seen since 2014, American, United, and Delta Airlines have suspended flights for at least the next couple of days, with the main airport in Tel Aviv receiving rocket fire and Israel targeting the Gaza Strip. Representatives say the airlines are monitoring the situation for when they might resume those flights. I'm Jackie Quinn.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he spoke with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas late Wednesday, urging an end to rocket attacks fired from Gaza by Hamas militants. The top diplomat also spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and pushed for both sides to de-escalate. The European Union's executive branch is calling on countries of the bloc to temporarily halt non-essential travel from India to limit the spread of COVID-19 variants. Meanwhile, a panel of international independent experts say the world bungled the COVID-19 response. AP's Rita Foley has more.
The experts faulted countries worldwide for a slow response to COVID-19, saying most waited to see how the virus was spreading until it was too late to contain it, leading to catastrophic results. They reviewed the World Health Organization's response to the pandemic, saying it should have the right to investigate emerging outbreaks wherever they are. That prompted an international political expert to ask, what nation is going to let the WHO in to investigate without its permission? Other experts criticized the panel for failing to hold the WHO and others accountable for their actions during the pandemic. I'm Rita Foley.
And this is VOA News. The International Olympic Committee on Wednesday downplayed concerns over Japanese public opinion, calling for the Tokyo Olympics to be canceled amid a state of emergency to curb surging COVID-19 cases. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Opposition in Japan seems to have hardened against an Olympics that cost at least $15 billion of mostly taxpayers' money.
We're fully concentrated on delivering the games.
Mark Adams says the IOC is listening but won't be guided by public opinion. The games are supposed to start in July. Coronavirus states of emergency in Tokyo and elsewhere in Japan have been extended. Adams says around 7,800 athletes have qualified for the games, 70% of the total quota.
There are a lot of sporting events going on around the world now, and I think this one will be the kind of a real tentpole moment that will bring the world together.
Adams also said a large and growing number of participants will be vaccinated before arriving at the athlete village. I'm Ed Donahue.
A three-day ceasefire agreed by the Taliban and Afghan forces begins today. Weeks of intense clashes throughout Afghanistan. The truce marks a Muslim holiday at the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. Violence has intensified in the country since Washington missed a May 1st deadline, agreed with the Taliban last year to withdraw all its troops. The U.S.'s largest pipeline is restarting 6 days after a ransomware attack prompted it to shut down the line, triggering fuel shortages and panic buying in the southeastern United States. AP's Jackie Quinn has more.
Colonial Pipeline says it will take several days for the product delivery supply chain to get back to normal, and service interruptions are still possible during the startup period for drivers, especially in North and Virginia. The shutdown brought fuel shortages, dried up gas tanks, and extra long lines.
I got things I gotta do, things I gotta go, things I gotta do.
Jamar Gaddison, an Uber Eats driver, he had to take the day off because of the fuel lines and cost.
I don't wanna have the line to get gas to the
AAA says the average price for a gallon of gasoline ticked above $3 for the first time since 2016.
This is VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandan President Museveni was sworn in Wednesday to a sixth term.
I, Yoweri Tuhawara Kaguta Museveni, swear in the name of the Almighty God that I shall faithfully exercise the functions of the President of Uganda and shall uphold, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. So help me God.
Sudan protesters demand justice after security forces fired on them. We'll have the story of a South Sudanese mother who says her son was allegedly assaulted in Egypt's capital. Gambia's president pardons 57 prisoners, some of them foreigners. A Malawi rights group threatens strike in support of a female anti-corruption czar.
The country has been looking for someone who can manage the institution without any bias. And now this person made the number one candidate and was recommended by the president to be confirmed. The country was shocked that Mahathir Zuma was rejected.
And the impact of violence on many Central African Republic communities. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda's president, Yoweri Museveni, was sworn in to a sixth term on Wednesday. In his inaugural speech, Museveni, who has been harshly criticized for repressing political opposition, said foreigners have no right to teach him about democracy. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
As he has five times before, Yoweri Museveni took the oath of office Wednesday.
I, Yoweri Tuhawara Kaguta Museveni, swear in the name of the Almighty God that I shall faithfully exercise the functions of the President of Uganda and shall uphold, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. So help me God.
Museveni and his National Resistance Movement Party were declared the winner of the January 14th elections with 58.6% of the vote. Opposition leader Bobi Wine and his National Unity Platform, which came in second with 34%, say the vote was rigged. During the campaign period, tens of Ugandan youth were either arrested, injured or killed as security forces tried to block Wine from holding rallies. One of those injured was 29-year-old Senjovu Jonathan, who was shot by a soldier as he walked home in Kampala on November 19th. He says Museveni's swearing in would mean something if the president promised to punish those who wounded or killed young people like him. He says government has never investigated whether the people they maimed and killed are helped. He says, I hoped that the president we chose was meant to swear in today, but that hasn't happened. Someone else has sworn in. He rigged the election, but will never settle until Uganda gets the change it deserves. The shootings during the campaign generated harsh criticism against Museveni both at home and internationally. But on Wednesday, Museveni dismissed his critics, saying Uganda never experienced democracy during times of colonialism and much of the post-colonial era. This is why, he says, he developed a democratic structure for Uganda.
It is therefore quite comic and laughable to hear of some actors in the world giving us lectures about democracy. We built this system for our people. We neither seek nor need any approbation from anybody outside Uganda.
In his speech, listened to by 11 presidents, Museveni preached African security, a united front, and the need to defend Africa from foreign enemies. The majority of the over 4,000 invited guests were supporters of the ruling party. Minister for the Presidency, Esther Mbayo, was elated about the swearing in.
Now he's starting a new term. That is the importance. To the NRM party, it is victory. Victory, victory, on and on and on and on.
Museveni will now head Uganda until 2025, when he will turn 82. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Sudan's transitional government is under fire after security forces used live ammunition Tuesday this week to disperse people marking the two-year anniversary of a pro-democracy protest, leaving two people dead. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
On June 3, 2019, soldiers opened fire on pro-democracy demonstrators who had surrounded military headquarters in Khartoum, killing more than 100 people. Relatives of the victims gathered around military headquarters in the capital Tuesday to remember those killed. This is Amira Kabous, deputy leader of the Families of the December Revolution organization, addressing the protesters. Kabous says at this historical crossroad at the Families of the Victims organize, they point their fingers at Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, head of the Rapid Support Forces, with committing the June 2019 massacre. They also accuse him of many abuses before and after the dispersal of the sit-in. A few hours after Tuesday's gathering, security troops fired live ammunition to disperse the remaining protesters and kill two people. Dozens more were injured, and eyewitnesses say many were arrested after the attack. Sudan's military denied any connection to the attack and said it didn't issue instructions to use live ammunition. The military said it will open an investigation. On Wednesday, the office of the Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok said Hamdok met with the generals, the heads of the interior and defense ministries, and other officials to discuss Tuesday's incident. In a news release, Hamdok expressed the transitional government's sorrow for the bloody events and the excessive use of power and called on the military and justice system to help with an investigation. The embassy of the United States expressed its shock and condemned the use of live ammunition, urging the transitional authorities to fully investigate the attack. Many officials and parties who have roles in the transitional government called on top officials to resign if authorities fail to name and prosecute the troops who opened fire. The transitional government came to power in 2019 after generals ousted longtime President Omar al-Bashir following months of mass protests against his rule. That August, protest leaders and the generals signed a power-sharing agreement. According to the agreement, military generals are due to hand over to a civilian leader named by the protest leaders later this month. June 3rd marks the two-year anniversary of the massacre. Pro-democracy protesters have proclaimed that date as a deadline for the transitional authorities to start prosecuting those behind that event and the killing of the two people on Tuesday. Neba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
The mother of a 14-year-old South Sudanese who was allegedly assaulted in the Egyptian capital Cairo last week says she continues to receive threats from people pressuring her to drop the case against a group of Egyptian youths who allegedly assaulted her son. She says neither South Sudanese diplomats in Cairo nor UN refugee officials have offered her protection. Viola Elias has the story from Juba.
The boy's mother, Rania Deng, says her son was humiliated, beaten, and forced to wash dishes while his female cousins were raped by the attackers on camera. Deng says her son and his two cousins were on their way to attend a birthday party at their auntie's house when they were attacked by a group of Egyptian boys in Cairo and Shem's residential area. A video showing Egyptian boy assaulting the South Sudanese boy went viral on social media last week. Rania Deng told South Sudan in Focus by phone that neither the South Sudan embassy nor the UNHCR have offered her family any kind of support since the incident happened.
I didn't see any sort of protection from our South Sudan's embassy. I didn't see anything. The ambassador talked to me during the time I was busy taking my boy for further medical checkups. But till now, I have not heard from him anymore. I have no protection.
But in a statement seen by South Sudan in Focus, the South Sudanese ambassador to Egypt, Joseph Nom, said action have been taken against the perpetrators. He says the youth were arrested and are in police custody. The statement says, quote, the embassy always seek to help all the members of our community, whether they are holders of South Sudanese passports or UNHCR cards, end quote. Ambassador Nom further said in the statement that as soon as he heard and watched the video clip, he engaged his contacts and competent authorities in order to grant the safety of the South Sudanese boy's family. Deng says police arrested three of the boys involved in the attack, including their mother, but she says two of the attackers, including the one who tortured her son, are still at large. Deng says some of the teenagers involved in the attack admitted raping the boy's sister.
They admitted that they raped some young girls, and they have also been taken for further laboratory tests, and now we are waiting for the results so that they don't deny it. The investigation is still ongoing.
Deng says despite receiving countless threats, she is determined to pursue the case until her children receive justice.
What I want is only that the right of my boy should be recognized. I don't want this case to be played with. I want our ambassador to intervene and make sure that those criminals are punished.
A video of the attack has outraged many people, including South Sudanese in the diaspora. South Sudan in Focus reached out to the Egyptian embassy in Juba for comment on attack. A secretary at the embassy said the Egyptian ambassador to Juba, Muhammad Kadid, who is the only person in the embassy authorized to speak to the media, was on leave. The Egyptian embassy in Juba issued a statement on their Twitter page condemning the attack, calling it unjust behavior. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 13. The Human Rights Defenders Coalition, HRDC of Malawi, is threatening to organize a March to Parliament protest May 18 to demand a second vote for Martha Chizuma as head of the country's anti-corruption bureau. HRDC leader Gift Trapen says Malawians, including President Lastro Chakwera, were surprised when the Public Appointment Committee of Parliament rejected Chizuma's nomination. Trapen says Malawi has had a corruption problem for years, and Chizuma has been a crusader against graft. President Chakwera has accused the Public Appointment Committee of sabotaging his administration's desire to fight corruption. Some Malawians say the committee is nonpartisan and should not be demonized as such. Trapen says HRDC has information that the Appointment Committee flouted some procedures.
What we have experienced as a country is the weak and corrupt view as an institution. The country has been looking for someone as a leader who can manage the institution without any bias. So what happened was, all along we had the ombudsman person, Ms. Martha Chizuma, who has been working professionally as the ombudsman person. And now this person, we made the number one candidate and was recommended by the president to parliament to be confirmed as the next anti-corruption bureau, because this person is qualified. The country was shocked that Martha Chizuma was rejected, but the rejection were looked at as more political, that people were afraid of Martha Chizuma in terms of her heading the anti-corruption bureau. So the demonstration that we are doing is to force parliament to be transparent enough in terms of how they rate the candidate, but also we want her name to be tabled back so that we have a transparent process where Malawians also can follow the proceedings when she's being considered to be the anti-corruption bureau director.
The Parliamentary Public Affairs Committee said that the committee is nonpartisan, and it wonders why organizations like your organization is demonizing the committee.
We are not demonizing the committee. In the first place, members of parliament are there to represent the citizens, and we have information in terms of how some procedures were floated in the committee, and that is why people were raising these concerns. So people are justified to question in the process if they think that process is not fair enough.
I wanted to respond to what the director said. He indicated they wrote Ms. Chizuma and they raised some issues telling her to desist from the tendency of applying the law very selectively. Do you understand what that means?
I think the issue, if the law is being applied selectively, that is upon the court, because the courts are the ones who are entrusted to interpret the law. So if the head of an institution is at fault, those who are victimized, they can seek a court recourse. So in this case, I don't think people should be worried to question someone, whether he's speaking individuals. But what I think we need to talk around is whether that individual is able to deliver. But I have to assure you that Malawians have the biggest trust in this Martha Chizuma because of her track record at the Ombudsman office.
My understanding, Gift, is that even the president President Chakwera is also disappointed by this rejection. And now your protest is 7 days to redo the interview, is that correct, and confirm Chizuma?
Yes, we are happy that the president acknowledged also through his frustration that he communicated to the country. But also, we are happy that today there was a motion that was moved to parliament and they have passed it, meaning that come next week, they're going to discuss about what happened during the confirmation process. This is what we want to see happen.
So I know your protest is scheduled for, I think, the 18th. Are you still planning on the protest?
It will depend on the outcome of the meeting on Monday. If we'll be satisfied or Malawi will be satisfied, we're going also to communicate our position. But as of now, our demonstrations are still on.
Gift, thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
Gift Trapens is leader of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition of Malawi. He was speaking with us from the capital, Blantyre. Gambian President Adamawa Barrow Wednesday pardoned 57 convicted prisoners, some of them foreigners. The government said the move was a gesture in observance of the Muslim feast. As Pandere Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina, the government also said some of the pardoned prisoners will immediately be deported to their respective countries.
The pardoned prisoners were 57, 41 of them Gambians, 10 Senegalese, 3 Conakry Guineans, 2 Nigerians, and 1 Indian. The government said the non-Gambian released prisoners shall be deported immediately. In a televised address on Wednesday, President Barrow spoke the need for forgiveness in the month of Ramadan.
Ramadan is regarded as a blessed period associated with repentance, piety, and abstinence from wrongdoing. It is a month in which acts of charity, good neighborliness, and discipline in both spiritual and worldly life are encouraged and practiced. Having sought forgiveness, mercy, and blessings during the holy month, we should be guided by the same spirit and continue to promote togetherness, peace, and stability.
The president's gesture came at a time when Muslims around the world are today observing Eid prayers, marking the end of Ramadan.
I thank the Almighty God for the blessing of witnessing this joyful moment, marking the end of the holy month of Ramadan. As we look forward to celebrating the Feast of Eid al-Fitr, locally referred to as Koriti, I congratulate all Muslims on the occasion.
The pardoning of the prisoners came at a time when the Gambia is witnessing a surge in crime rate. Rape, murder, and robbery have been on the increase. President Barrow again.
I cannot fail to seize this opportunity to address some pressing national issues of security and public safety. As we all know, peace and stability form the bedrock for development. It is regretted, therefore, that there have been disturbing reports of domestic violence in our communities and criminal acts of drug abuse, theft, destruction of property, and other forms of crimes.
The president cited the Sanyang rioting incident in which foreign business owners were attacked by the villagers.
These crimes pose a threat to peace and stability and can hamper our development efforts. The incident reported in Sanya is a case in point. It is alarming that Gambian youths can take the law into their own hands to the extent of destroying a police station, looting businesses, and displacing law-abiding persons who had amicably integrated themselves into the Gambian community.
The president noted that the impact of that incident has affected the lives of a whole community, including foreign direct investment. He has called on Gambians to be law-abiding and avoid any act that would jeopardize the country's peace and stability. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Residents of many Central African Republic communities have seen an upsurge in violence since last December, said Marcella Cray, interim head of Doctors Without Borders in the country. Cray spoke to Ricky Stryak about the impact the violence is having on people's access to health care and more.
What we're seeing very directly with the violence is that we get the people with gunshot wounds that need surgical care. But what we're also seeing in the areas right around is a lot of abandoned villages. So where the whole population has fled into the bush or are staying in their field away from the fighting to flee from the fighting. So we have a lot of people on the move in the whole country. And
how has the conflict disrupted medical services for the residents who have had to flee or have stayed in the region?
So what we see as Doctors Without Borders is that in many of the places where we intervene, where we have responded to the crisis, health centers have been looted. So you have to imagine already the health center is pretty minimal. There's not that much medication. But now, after the looting, there's absolutely zero medication. Even the furniture is being taken away in some cases. And so what you see is actually an empty building with maybe some packaging of medication on the floor and empty other than that. Some places we've even seen bullet holes in the walls. So that means there's been actual fighting inside or near the health center.
If someone does make it to an MSF health center or to an MSF facility, what kind of injuries are you guys seeing where you're able to work?
So in the places where we are working as Doctors Without Borders, what we do see is people coming in with gunshot wounds, for instance. So that's a direct impact of the fighting. But we also see people that, like small children, have serious cases of malaria. Because it's very difficult for people to actually reach the health centers, it means that it takes more time, and by then the child is often in a much more serious condition than normally would have to be the case.
What do you think about, you know, these long-term effects on the population, because this crisis has been going on for so long? Really, I know there's been ebbs and flows, but things like malaria, what kind of a long-term impact do they have on a population that maybe aren't easy to see today or even tomorrow, but, you know, have this effect on the development of children or societies or stress on a population?
Thank you very much for asking that question. So Central African Republic, like I said, it's a very, you know, conflictuous country, and we see cycles of violence in this last few months. It's another example of just a lot of violence happening. And what it means is that not only are people not getting health care, but we'll also see an increase in malnutrition, for instance, which of course affects the development of the children in the future. We see pregnant women not being able to access health care and dying. We see people living with HIV that can't access their medication and get very, very sick. So really, this is not only short-term, but certainly also very long-term effects on the population. And on top of that, in terms of mental health, just imagine that growing up and living in a country where there's regular cycles of violence, that has to impact also on people's mental health situations.
That was Marcella Cray, interim head of Doctors Without Borders in the Central African Republic. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from the capital, Bangui. And that's it for this Thursday, May 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day.
I'm Kim Lewis, your moderator for Issues in the News. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the latest top stories of the week, including U.S. regulators authorized the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine to be used by children as young as 12 years of age, widening the pool of those eligible to get inoculated. Listen to Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndumbulu and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.